From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Pressure is building for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign. The majority of state lawmakers are now calling for his ouster, and the state assembly has announced it's opening an impeachment inquiry into Cuomo's behavior in light of multiple sexual misconduct allegations against him. Joining us for more on this fallout is John Campbell. He's an Albany reporter for the USA Today Network. John, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So Governor Cuomo has denied wrongdoing, but tell us more about this impeachment inquiry. What can we expect?
So we saw the state assembly launch what they're calling an impeachment investigation, and essentially they're giving the Assembly Judiciary Committee the power to investigate Governor Cuomo with subpoena power, which is very, very important because now they can compel witnesses to testify. They can compel the production of documents. And really what this is the culmination of several weeks of brewing scandals that have really boiled over the top in Albany. One is about nursing homes with the collection of nursing home data and the release of nursing home data during COVID-19. The state underrepresented how many people had died of COVID-19 in nursing homes by omitting those who had died in hospitals. And then we've also seen six allegations of sexual harassment or misconduct in some form. And the assembly inquiry apparently is going to look at all of that. It is happening at the same time as there's an attorney general's investigation, which is civil in nature, but that is looking specifically at the sexual harassment and misconduct claims.
How are these investigations and calls for Cuomo to resign impacting his ability to govern? It's budget season in New York, correct?
Absolutely. It comes at the most important time in the state government calendar, and that is when they negotiate a new state budget. And traditionally, that happens with the governor, the leader of the Senate, and the leader of the assembly. But now you have a situation where the leader of the Senate, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, a fellow Democrat, has called for his resignation, and you have a situation where the assembly speaker, Carl Hastie, has authorized this investigation. And they're all supposed to come together somehow and negotiate a $192 billion spending plan that not only is financial in nature, but in New York, all sorts of policy issues get thrown in there. And one that people were watching this year was the legalization of marijuana. But now that's all thrown into doubt as, you know, as there are serious questions about whether the governor can negotiate with the legislature.
Cuomo has survived several scandals in the past. What are some examples, and how do you think he was able to overcome those?
Well, the biggest one had to do with his top aide and his close friend, somebody who's referred to as a brother in the past, and that is a guy by the name of Joe Percoco. And he was accused and convicted of taking essentially $315,000 worth of bribes from companies with business before the state who were donors to Andrew Cuomo's campaign. And that one never quite stuck to Andrew Cuomo because there was never quite evidence that showed that he was aware of it, whether he authorized anything like that. He was never charged in that. He was investigated for his closure of what's known as the Moreland Commission in 2014 and 15. Which was a panel that he created to investigate public corruption in New York, but then he abruptly shut it down as part of state budget negotiations. But those were scandals that never rose to the public consciousness like this, in part because Andrew Cuomo became a political celebrity throughout COVID-19 with his briefings.
Right. Well, I've been wondering, you've been reflecting on the differences in how Governor Cuomo presents himself on the national stage versus how the state views him. You've been covering him locally from Albany for a decade now. What contrasts stand out to you?
Well, I mean, really, the big difference now is the level of attention that he's receiving, right? Like, there are a lot of stories and questions now about a hostile workplace environment. But those stories and questions have been out there for a decade, really. I mean, it has been well known that he is, to put it politely, hard charging. He's very aggressive, even with members of his staff. But, you know, there's also the Me Too aspect to this can't be underplayed because a lot of the interactions that women had with the governor have taken a lot of time to process. And so when you're hearing these women who worked for him who, you know, say he called her sweetheart or, you know, put his hand on her lower back or cupped their face with his hands and kissed her cheek. Those are interactions that took time for these women to process. And it's also, you know, in this new realm of consciousness about those kind of allegedly harassing incidents and what damage they can do to the women who experience them.
Do you think he'll be able to get past this current scandal?
It's going to be very difficult for him. He's made very clear to this point, when we're speaking, that he does not intend to resign based on allegations alone. His point has been, let's wait for the investigation. Now there's two investigations, and he's trying to get any supporters he can muster to back that position, to wait for the allegation, for the investigation to finish. And really, that would just buy him some time. You know, the calculation changes if there's some sort of blockbuster revelation, another blockbuster revelation, I should say. You know, every article that comes out pushes more and more lawmakers towards supporting impeachment or calls for his resignation. And, you know, there's a question about what point does the heat become too much for him.
That's John Campbell. He's an Albany reporter for the USA Today Network. John, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow marks 1 year since Louisville police shot and killed Breonna Taylor while executing a no-knock warrant at her apartment. In the year since, her face has appeared on billboards, on the covers of magazines. Protesters have chanted her name around the world, and she's the inspiration for a proposed law in Congress. Kentucky Public Radio's Ryland Barton reports.
It felt like there was a lot of momentum to pass policing reforms in Kentucky last year. During a demonstration in Louisville in early June, thousands showed up to protest the police killing of Breonna Taylor. The city responded quickly with a ban on no-knock warrants and the creation of a citizen review board to oversee police. And in the legislature, lawmakers from both parties voiced support for banning no-knocks statewide and putting other reforms in place.
Kentucky can be cruel to black women, even in death.
Attica Scott is a Democratic state representative, a former Louisville Metro Councilperson, and community activist. Her bill to ban no-knock warrants and create penalties for officers who don't turn on their body cameras, Breonna's Law for Kentucky, got its first hearing on Wednesday, but Republican lawmakers made it clear it wouldn't receive a vote.
I filed Breonna's Law in August of 2020 so that people would have plenty of time to tear the bill apart and provide good and important feedback. But that did not happen.
Instead, a bill sponsored by Republican Senate President Robert Stivers limiting no-knock warrants is advancing. Stivers' bill doesn't go as far as Scott's. It would still allow no-knock warrants, but only in cases involving violent crime, and it would require them to be executed between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m.
I truly appreciate Representative Scott's work in this area, and I don't think that we are seeking different outcomes. I think we are just looking at it from a different method.
Stivers didn't file his bill until earlier this month and says he's open to making changes based on Scott's recommendations. The bill ended up passing unanimously out of committee, but Scott voted pass.
Even though there's a lot that President Stivers and I don't agree on, when we can come together to have conversations about important issues, we should.
Another item protesters in Louisville have been calling for is giving subpoena power to the city's new civilian review board. The legislature would have to authorize that. But proposals so far would only indirectly give subpoena power to the board. A House bill would require subpoenas to be approved by a Metro Council committee. Republican Representative Jason Nemes says elected officials, not citizens, should be the ones to sign off on subpoenas.
That is, as everyone knows, a very big and awesome power. The documents would come to the Ethics Committee of elected officials. When, if they misbehave, they can be run out of office.
Protesters have continued to apply pressure on the legislature. Last week, a caravan of demonstrators gathered at the Capitol to call for the passage of Breonna's Law. Meanwhile, the legislature has been advancing proposals to boost penalties for people who protest. Republican Senator Danny Carroll is a retired police officer from Paducah. He sponsored a bill that would make it a crime to insult a police officer, saying police need to be able to react to disrespectful behavior.
If you see in these riots, you see people getting up in officers' faces, yelling in their ears, doing everything they can to provoke a violent response. But there has to be a method to allow officers to react to that, because that does nothing but incite those around that vicinity, and it furthers and it escalates the riotous behavior.
Another bill would give Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron power to prosecute common protest charges like disorderly conduct that are normally handled locally. Cameron is also forming a task force to study search warrant policies, though the panel is mostly made up of government officials and organizations representing police, judges, and prosecutors. At a recent rally in Frankfurt, Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, called for protesters to keep pushing.
Just don't give up and don't lose focus on what we're really here to do.
There's only a little time left for lawmakers to act. The legislative session ends on March 30th. For Here and Now, I'm Ryland Barton in Louisville.
The World Health Organization today moved to ease concerns about AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine. The WHO says there's no reason to stop using that vaccine, even though several countries, including Italy, Denmark, and Romania, suspended administering it over blood clot fears. We should note the AstraZeneca vaccine is not authorized for use here in the United States, but it is part of the global effort of COVID vaccinations called COVAX. And for more, we're joined by Dr. Seema Yasmin, an epidemiologist and author of Viral BS, Medical Myths and Why We Fall for Them. Dr. Yasmin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Yasmin, the European Medicines Agency says there have been about 30 cases of blood clotting events among 5 million people who received the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe. What's important to note about this finding?
So the important thing to note is that, as you mentioned, those proportions, about 5 million people across the European Union have received this vaccine made by AstraZeneca in conjunction with the researchers at Oxford University. And as you noted, Tanya, about 30 people have reported what we describe in medical language as thromboembolic events. We've also heard reports preliminarily of two deaths, one amongst a Navy officer and another amongst a police officer. And this is why, as a reaction, we've seen at least 10 European nations, and as of today, Thailand as well, saying that they're either delaying rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine, outright not going to use this vaccine, or in some cases saying specifically there are some batches that they will not be distributing. In fact, in Thailand, the Prime Minister was scheduled to roll up their sleeve and receive the AstraZeneca vaccine today as part of rolling out that vaccine across the nation. And they said, hold up, based on this, we're delaying it.
Okay. With all of this in mind, what should we make of all of this?
The important thing to remember is that there are some proportion of people who are going to get blood clots anyway, right? Who are going to get sick with some things anyway. So it's fair to say we need to investigate, but I can understand why the EMA and the WHO is saying, hold on, there's no indication that this vaccine causes blood clots, so please don't stop using it.
You do understand why people are apprehensive, though. I mean, every day there's a story about vaccine side effects. Many of them are one-offs, but they are alarming. How should people interpret the news they're hearing when weighing their decision on whether to get a COVID vaccine or not?
It's really important to bear in mind that even though COVID vaccines were developed in 10 months, which is a lot quicker than it usually takes, there weren't corners cut in terms of the actual rigorous scientific process of developing a vaccine. And so clinical trials were designed exactly for this, to distinguish early on, does this vaccine cause really bad anaphylaxis? Does this vaccine cause blood clots? So what I would urge people to remember is that we have cognitive biases that bring to mind some of the reporting we've seen that was really anecdotal. And what we have to try and do to counter that bias is keep the big picture in mind. Bear in mind how many people have contracted COVID-19, how many have died from it, and the really important role that vaccines are playing in getting us out of the pandemic. And then using all of that assessment as a way of kind of weighing the risks of a potential vaccine versus the benefits of a vaccine. And truly, the benefits when it comes to the authorized vaccine so far, the benefits outweigh the risks.
Okay, so keeping the big picture in mind is your advice to listeners. When should we start paying attention to side effects?
We should always be mindful of side effects, in that when you get a vaccine, almost for anything, to be honest, not just COVID-19, you should stick around in the clinic for 15 minutes afterwards, for example, because most reactions to vaccines happen that soon after vaccination. But otherwise, If you can, don't try and pay attention to every single news report about someone who may not have had a reaction that may or may not was linked back to the vaccine. But do be on the lookout for any announcements that come from regulators like the FDA, that come from the European Medicines Agency, announcements that come from CDC or WHO, because they're investigating now whether the AstraZeneca vaccine really does cause blood clots. And right now, there isn't evidence that it does.
Dr. Seema Yasmin is an epidemiologist and author of Viral BS, Medical Myths, and Why We Fall for Them. Doctor, thank you so much for laying all of this out for us.
Thank you.
The Boss is back, and he's teaming up with another boss. The new podcast, Renegades, Born in the USA, features conversations like this next one between Bruce Springsteen and former President Barack Obama.
Contrary to the song of a great American master, we're generally not born to run. Most of us are born to run a little bit and then go back home.
It's more than just jokes. New episodes are dropping on Spotify. For more, we're joined by NPR's Eric Deggans. He covers more than TV, by the way. Eric, welcome.
Yeah, great to be here.
You can kind of hear it there. Obama and Springsteen have been buddies since 2008 when they met on the campaign trail. What did you think? What was it like to listen to these two talk to each other for the better part of an hour per episode?
Well, first of all, let's just be honest. It's the coolest hang on the planet, right? To be able to be in the room with one of the world's biggest rock stars and, of course, one of the world's most impactful politicians. Mm. And they seem to sort of look at things like music and race the same way. And it's just kind of amazing to hear the two of them talk, and especially to hear Obama finally dig into talking about race.
Eric, we've got a clip of that. Why don't we listen to it?
So if you ask me, theoretically, are reparations justified? The answer is yes. The wealth of this country, the power of this country, was built in significant part on the backs of slaves.
You know, Eric, you're right. That is interesting, because I don't know that we ever heard Obama say he supported reparations while he was in office. So what kind of glimpse are we getting here at the former president?
You know, he, being the pragmatist that he is, seemed to have decided to focus on getting things done as president as opposed to talking about things. It's really great to hear him loosen up a little and feel like he can talk about that stuff now.
Eric, what about that moment when the former president talks about popping somebody in the nose when he was a kid over a racial comment?
And I remember I popped him in the face and broke his nose. And we were in the locker room.
Well done.
And suddenly blood's pouring down. And it was just reacting. I said, what? And I popped him. And he said, why'd you do that? And I explained to him, I said, don't you ever call me something like that.
Wow.
You know, I got to say, you know, when I was a kid, the first time a white person called me the N-word, I popped him too. So I totally sympathize with the action. Wow. But beyond that, it was just nice to hear the president tell us about something that he probably would not have felt comfortable admitting while he was in office.
All right. So we heard quite a bit there from the former president. What about Bruce Springsteen? What does he bring to these conversations?
Well, for me, there was a great moment where he talks about some of the rioting that happened around Freehold, New Jersey, and Asbury Park, New Jersey, where he grew up. What's interesting, too, is that, you know, I was a music critic for the Asbury Park Press for a few years in the mid-90s.
Wow.
I interviewed him a
it's
couple
all coming
of times.
Home here.
Well, yeah, it's always coming home with Bruce Springsteen. And I wouldn't say that I got to know him, but I would say that I got a sense of how he cared about racial issues and social justice and things like that. When Bruce Springsteen's backup band first started, the band was almost half black. But before too long, that the personnel shifted, and then his saxophone player, longtime saxophone player, Clarence Clemons, was the only black man in the band. And I think we have a clip where he talks about it. Let's check it out.
Once the keyboardist and drummer left, it left Clarence as the, he was the only black man in the room a lot of times.
You know, being in the band, you know, you see very few black people in the shows, you know, and I look for it, you know. But he's not being marketed that way, and so very few black people get a chance to hear him. I don't know whether...
He had to swim in white culture for most of his work life.
Right.
You know?
And we did hear from Clarence Clemens there. That was his voice, just so people know.
Yeah. And, you know, what I thought was so insightful about that is that I have also, again, I'm a musician. I've been in bands where I've been the only black person in the band. Hmm. You know, I remember being in a club one time talking to somebody and somebody threw a bottle at me. And the rest of the people in the band, you know, didn't even notice. And so to have Bruce sort of notice what Clarence was going through, I thought was really insightful. We're finding out something new about the relationship that he had with Clarence Clemens. Even after Clarence has been gone, you know, he passed away a while ago, this still felt like something that we hadn't heard a lot of and that was something kind of special.
So here we have these two just mega, mega celebrities in American life and culture, and they're sitting across the table from each other, giving a glimpse at their friendship, which I think is fascinating for people to eavesdrop on. But what do you think? Are they delivering in this medium? Because, you know, podcasting is not something that Bruce Springsteen or Barack Obama really, like, are known for.
Well, I got to say, if you're Bruce Springsteen and Barack Obama, you're going to get a lot of help with your podcast. It is very well put together. It's very well produced. Bruce has a guitar with him. And one thing that really struck me was that, like, at the beginning of one of the episodes, Barack Obama is singing while Bruce Springsteen is playing. And I was thinking to myself, that takes some kind of guts to try to sing in front of Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was a fun moment.
You know what, Eric? I was thinking they probably have better microphones than even we do. NPR critic Eric Deggans, thanks very much.
You know, sometimes you don't want the mic to be that good. I'm just saying.
Brings out all the imperfections.
Am I casting aspersions on Barack Obama's voice? I am not doing that. But listen to that thing and you'll see what I'm saying. So much fun to talk to you.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we help you make sense of one big story in the news every day, like how to combat disinformation and conspiracy theories, which pose a real threat to democracy, and what life looks like after you're vaccinated, the next phase of do's and don'ts. All that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
Netflix users beware. The company is considering a crackdown on customers who share their passwords with friends or family members. Netflix knows many of its 200 million subscribers are piggybacking on someone else's account, and now the company is testing a new pop-up message asking some users to verify that they own the account they're trying to log into. Peter Kafka is senior correspondent at Recode and host of Recode Media. Hi, Peter.
Hi there.
So what is Netflix up to here?
Well, that's a good question. Their official line is, this is just a test. Who knows what who knows what we're going to do? But in theory, it looks like they might be reconsidering a long-time stance they've had, which is basically, we're not telling you to do this, but we're not going to complain if you share your Netflix password with a lot of other people. They're doing a test that says, you know, if, for instance, you've ever borrowed a Netflix password, you might see a pop-up on your TV saying, hey, you can only do this if you have a Netflix account with us. And if you do, let us know and we'll send you a login and you can get on yourself. It appears to be nudging you towards going from freeloader to paying Netflix subscriber.
Well, it does seem to me that it could sort of be like the end of an era because people have been sharing passwords for as long as Netflix has been around. And, you know, just a few years ago, CEO Reed Hastings said password sharing is something that you have to learn to live with. So why crack down now?
Well, we don't know if they're cracking down. You know, the obvious conclusion you can draw is Netflix used to sort of own streaming. that didn't have any competition. And now there's a lot of competition from Disney and Discovery mm-hmm. Plus and Paramount Plus and HBO Max. And the suggestion would be, all right, we'd like people paying for us instead of paying for HBO Max or Paramount Plus. We'd like people to make a decision. I'm not sure that's the case. There's also a theory here that Netflix is just testing out account security. You know, Netflix doesn't give free trials anymore. They used to do that. They've moved away from that. And so if you want to tease this all the way out, then maybe saying, look, you know what Netflix is. You like it. It's time for you to start paying. It would also suggest, if that theory holds up, that Netflix is thinking, look, we've got 200 million subscribers worldwide, about 70 million in the U.S. How many more are we going to acquire without getting the freeloaders to start paying? But again, we're doing some speculation here.
Sure. And do you have any idea, like, how common it is for people to share passwords? I mean, I personally know it happens a lot.
I've shared my password for HBO with my entire family at various points. And I think they've all ended up paying for their own at one point. I think that was the theory for a long time for a lot of these streamers was, look, we'd rather have you paying, but you're also sort of giving us free marketing. There's a consulting firm, Magid & Associates, that estimates that maybe 30% of Netflix users are sharing, I guess is the polite euphemism, passwords. Anecdotally, it's a lot of people because there really hasn't been any reason not to. Hear during the pandemic people who'd been used to sharing their passwords. And, you know, in theory, Netflix lets you stream multiple accounts at the same time. During the pandemic, when everyone was at home streaming Netflix, you've heard that people were running into that limit already. So this is something that could have been stirred up by the pandemic.
Yeah, business has been pretty good, I think, for Netflix. It gained an extra 37 million customers during the pandemic because of all those people staying at home watching the TV. Peter Kafka, senior correspondent at Recode and host of Recode Media, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been 1 year since Texas prisoners have been able to visit their family members because of the pandemic. During that time, prisoners have dealt with massive outbreaks that sickened and killed fellow prisoners and staff. Well, starting today in Texas, that will change as loved ones will be able to visit again in person with some restrictions. 2 visits a month with 1 adult allowed. No physical touching. Kirsten Ricketts hasn't seen her husband, Jeremy, since March of 13th of last year, and she's on the steering committee of the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition Statewide Leadership Council, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, thanks for being here, Kirsten. So your husband is currently incarcerated at the Polunsky Unit Prison in Livingston, Texas. What does it feel like now, knowing that you're very close to being able to see him again?
Well, I tell you, I'm a nervous wreck because I think I've aged 10 years in the last year and I've put on 20 pounds in this coronavirus. And so I guess there's a lot of apprehension mixed with excitement and a little bit of fear. And it's so many mixed emotions going on at the same time. I don't know if I can really describe it.
Yeah, because it's been a long time. I mean, what's it been like to go this long without seeing him? How have you all kept in touch?
I'm 12 minutes from the prison. So when I drive through the middle of town, I pass the exit to the unit on a daily basis. And during this time, my husband actually contracted the coronavirus. And they put him into a separate area in the prison. And during that time frame, there were intermittent weeks and months that we didn't have any telephone contact at all.
How is he feeling now?
Well, for him, he was in relatively good health when all of this happened. So I'm going to say he's pretty much back to normal, pretty much.
What about conditions inside of the prison where your husband is incarcerated? What measures have they been able to do to stop the spread of this virus?
Well, they have been short-staffed. There is a shortage of 5,500 officers within the Texas Department of Corrections at this time. They've had to shut down areas and pass out food. My husband was in a dorm area outside of the main area, but there were 6 or 7 guys at the end of the line, the very end of the line, who did not get any food at all. And I don't know where the meals were going, but they weren't making it to the end of the line.
You were also previously incarcerated, and since then, you've dedicated your life to helping people reenter society when they get out of prison. I mean, cynics may say, well, not being able to see loved ones for a year or more is kind of part of the punishment. But you're making the case that this is not the case. This is vital. It's vital to be able to see your loved ones, not only for you and your family, but for your husband as well.
That's right. It is the connection to family that instills hope in the individual. The place where they live under the conditions that they're living in, the Texas prison system, the maintenance problems with inside the buildings is god awful. A lot of these buildings are old and dilapidated. They've got windows busted out. There's no heating. There's no air conditioning. There's rats running around. There's roaches running around. They are living in these squalid conditions already before this coronavirus fell through. And then when you have no contact to the outside world and you're unable to see the people that you love and there's no communication, the suicide rates within Texas Department of Criminal Justice doubled in 2020 with the coronavirus and everything else that was going on. So on top of all of this stuff, the troubles within the system, a whole new light has been shed.
What are you going to do when you first see Jeremy's face?
I'm probably going to cry. And when I do get to see him, I'm not going to be able to hug him or touch him. So it's a face-to-face visit, but he'll still be behind a plexiglass and I'll be able to talk to him through some sort of a phone monitor that is attached to the system that they have set up for non-contact visits.
That's Kirsten Ricketts of the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition's Statewide Leadership Council. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And Kirsten's husband, Jeremy, has been in prison for more than 20 years on a murder conviction. He's up for parole in 3 years. Well, like many Americans, people in prison will be getting checks from the federal government as part of the relief bill signed by President Biden. The majority of state and federal prisoners are eligible to receive a check, but advocates say the system to get that money needs a big overhaul. The Northwest News Network's Tom Bonzi has more from Washington State.
Michael J. Moore is serving time at the Monroe Correctional Complex northeast of Seattle for 3 robberies. He says he was unsure last year whether people like him would get economic stimulus payments.
There's this bias against prisoners, you know. They might say something along the lines of, well, why are we giving this money to prisoners? They don't need it, not realizing that some of us do. A lot of prisoners are only incarcerated temporarily, and they still have children to support. They have house payments. They have bills. And a lot of their families have been affected by COVID to a greater degree with only one breadwinner left in the household, right?
Moore says he was included in both the $1,200 first round and $600 second round of checks, but none of the money actually reached his pocket.
So I lost all the money to a child support debt. Fortunately, my child support was paid off after that.
Past due child support is just one of many items states can deduct from an inmate's outside income. Other deductions include unpaid court fees and fines, crime victims' compensation, and various costs of incarceration. Catherine Bentley is an attorney at the Public Defender Association in Seattle. She's trying to get more relief money into more prisoners' hands. On her desk, she has a stack of 50 letters from local inmates describing heavy garnishment of their federal stimulus checks.
On average, it's about 50 to 60%, and the most egregious was one gentleman was $900 was taken out of his check, which is 75% of the total stimulus money.
Bentley contends total deductions over 35% are excessive in most cases, but the Washington State Department of Corrections disagrees. Agency spokeswoman Susan Biller says Congress shielded the second round of payments from most garnishments, but not the first.
These are all based on statute, and so we are just processing that based on following the statutes.
Corrections departments across the country found themselves in the middle of a head-twisting back and forth that began last spring. It started with Congress directing relief money to go out fast. A short time later, the IRS sent a memo to prisons saying essentially, oops, we didn't mean to cut inmate checks, send those back. Months later, a federal judge says, actually no, deliver the money after all. This past weekend, Senate Republicans forced an up or down vote on whether to include or exclude prisoners from receiving the next round of $1,400 checks. GOP senators argued it's inappropriate and a waste of $1.9 billion to give stimulus checks to inmates. Their amendment narrowly failed on a party line vote. Catherine Bentley with the Public Defender Group says the federal court in particular made it clear that incarcerated people are entitled to the federal relief money. In her words, just like everyone else is.
We had the argument, we had the debate, and the judge ruled. So now it's time for the prisons to comply.
State corrections departments that tracked as the earlier stimulus checks were deposited in inmate accounts say considerably fewer than half of inmates got one. Advocacy groups are highly critical of what they consider to be roadblocks created by state prison policies. Filing a tax return is the best way for most Americans to make sure they're on the government's radar for a stimulus check. Easier said than done from behind bars.
We do not have an H&R Block in prison, no.
Susan Biller says the Washington State Department of Corrections has tried to be helpful by distributing model tax forms to prisoners. Generally, it takes its cues on this from the federal government.
I believe that we will do as instructed. It is always helpful if they provide us with clear information that stays the same moving forward.
Legal aid groups in many states are now laying the groundwork for mass mailing of tax forms and instructions for prisoners on how to secure the latest round of stimulus checks. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
Democratic socialists now control the Democratic Party of Nevada in a surprising power shift that could have implications for liberal politics. Progressive candidates backed by the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America won all five party leadership positions in a contested election last Saturday. That prompted an exodus by the remaining staff. John Ralston is editor of the Nevada Independent. He joins us now. John, welcome back.
Hi, Peter.
So this is typically a pretty mundane affair, a state party leadership election, but what happened exactly here?
Well, I don't know how mundane they are for those involved. Those voting in these kinds of elections are the real party faithful and the activists, and they're very passionate and emotional. This one is unprecedented in the sense that, as you mentioned, you essentially had what has been a 4 years in the making takeover of the party by supporters of Bernie Sanders, including a leader who is a member of the Las Vegas Democratic Socialists of America and was supported by that far left wing of the party. But she defeated, this is what's really interesting about it, Peter, maybe the most liberal person ever elected in Nevada, a Clark County commissioner and former legislator. So it was really the left versus the far left, and the far left won.
Can you remind us how this evolution happened over the last few years? Because there was a fair amount of conflict within the state party back in 2016, if I remember, when Bernie Sanders lost Nevada to Hillary Clinton. And then in 2020, he won the state caucuses handily.
That's right. In 2016, Hillary Clinton defeated Bernie Sanders by about 5 points, if I remember correctly, on caucus day. But because of the arcane rules that exist for the state party, you then elect the delegates through the county convention and then the state convention. The Bernie Sanders folks didn't give up after caucus day. They took over most of the county conventions, but didn't quite get enough people to the state convention. And there was a near riot and it was shut down. But they didn't give up, and in the ensuing 4 years, they kept organizing, and they controlled enough votes on caucus day in 2020, Peter, to win by a landslide over Joe Biden, more than 2-1. And that is how they then won those seats on what is called the State Central Committee and were able to elect one of their own just last weekend.
So from a practical point of view, what does this mean for Nevada Democrats that the establishment, long led by former Senator Harry Reid, has been upended? Are we going to start seeing primary challenges to sitting candidates on the left?
I think that's a fear, and that's exactly the right question, Peter, that this new group is more interested in holding incumbents accountable with their purity tests on whatever the issue might be, climate change, Medicare for all, a $15 minimum wage. And if they don't pass those litmus tests, then they will put primary candidates up again against them. But you used the right word. Practically, the Reid machine, the establishment Democrats here, essentially had used the state party as a way to funnel money from outside groups into voter registration programs and voter ID programs, get out the vote, those kinds of basic mechanics of what a state party should do. They have no faith now in this new leadership, and so they have pulled those resources. As you mentioned, the staff left. They transferred $450,000 out of that account to the National Senate Democratic Committee because there is a big U.S. Senate race here, not to mention six other statewide races, including governor. And so you have a parallel organization being set up. There is no way that anyone could argue that this is good for Democrats in Nevada going into a big campaign year.
Well, and one of the reasons this is so interesting outside of Nevada is that politics are changing so fast in the southwestern United States. Look at Arizona, voted for Joe Biden in the last presidential election. Nevada has shifted far to the left. This is happening across the Sun Belt. And a decade ago, most people would have been shocked to see something like this happen. Do you think that this rift in state politics there in Nevada is a sign of what's to come for the party on a national scale?
Yeah, it's a great question, Peter. And when I first started covering politics here, when I had much more hair and a lot less gray hair back in the mid-1980s, Nevada was a reliably Republican state for presidential politics. It is now just the opposite. The last four elections have been won here, and you mentioned what happened in Arizona. There is, and you see this in Congress too, with AOC and others and activist progressive base demanding certain things from the so-called establishment. The real question, though, is can they make an impact, and are their ideas the kinds of ideas that candidates can put in a general election against, for instance, a moderate Republican candidate and win? In Nevada, my guess, the answer to that question is no. We're still a relatively moderate state. Biden only won here by 2.5 points, as did Hillary Clinton. It's not like we are a deep blue state. And so that remains to be seen.
Yeah. John Ralston, editor of the Nevada Independent, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.